You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. Where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 1st, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday, ladies and gentlemen. I am wearing my Zumbas and a soft collared shirt. And as it is Casual Friday, joining us on the program today will be Cliff Schechter to round out the week in news. Political news, that is. Also joining us today, ostensibly to give me movie recommendations that I can stream over the weekend, as my family does not allow me to leave the house, Matt Graham, comedian, spoken word artist, former near Scrabble world champion, when I did comedy, he was doing comedy back in Boston, was one of the guys I admired, but I mean, I really enjoyed and looked up to his comedy. He will be joining us again, ostensibly to give us a movie recommendation. He's in the midst of his off-Broadway show, This Too Shall Suck, to give you a little sense of where he's come from. Just breaking. Two people have died, including what appears to be a suicide terrorist in a bombing at the entrance to the U.S. embassy in Turkey, in the Turkish capital, in Ankara. Unclear exactly what this is about. There are reports now that it's a guy from a leftist group, but it's very early to be able to give a sense, but that is just breaking. And also Ed Koch, former mayor of New York City from, 78 to 90? He has passed at age 88. I wasn't in New York at that time. He was known nationally. We interviewed him once on the earlier version of the Majority Report. I was never that much of a fan of his, but I will always remember, his, quote in the Central Park Five documentary when he was talking about the, Central Park jogger attack, saying it was the crime of the century, and how how much he seemed to really enjoy race baiting at the time. I think he subsequently reached out to the African-American community in New York City to make to basically clear the docket, clear the air, and give him room to be to anti-Muslim bait, which I think he found to be an effective tool for keeping him in the news over the years. So, I don't know. I guess rest in peace, Ed Koch. 88 years, you did okay for yourself. All right, we're going to take a quick break. You know, I never know what to say in those situations. I don't want to be mean. And, you know, he led the happy life. And the one brief encounter that he had with me may not have been that pleasant for him. I think we got into an arguing, a shouting match. But I'm sure that didn't really...
All I know is I refuse to call the Queensboro Bridge the Ed Koch Bridge.
You know what? I didn't even know that it was called the Ed Koch Bridge until you told me that you refused to call it the Ed Koch Bridge. So I will always refer to it as the Queensboro Bridge until somebody it's renamed after someone that, you know, I have a little more appreciation for. What did he do? What did he do? What did he do? Lower the tolls on the Queensboro Bridge? What did he do?
I think he just really likes the bridge.
Well, there you go. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Majority Report listeners can get a free audiobook right now by going to audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. Why not pick up Wendell Potter's book, Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. And you can get it for free now by going to audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. That's audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. Do it now. It's free. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Seder on the award-winning Majority Report. Back in from Washington, D.C. yesterday. And it's always a pleasure to welcome every week, every Friday to this program, Cliff Schechter. If not only for the opportunity to be able to play his theme song.
Cliff Schechter. Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
You know, I never noticed it before, Cliff, but you really hear some of Jimmy Reefercake's maniac accent there. Cliff Schechter.
I like to bring out Reefercake at his best.
There you go. And you always, always do, Cliff. Well,
I got to be honest with you, though. You know, lately, I've had at least a couple people on Twitter, like, almost rage at me and say, I can't get that song out of my head.
Yes, that's been an ongoing, is it a word? Complaint? I don't know if that's the right word, but a compliment ain't. Maybe no. I would call it that sticks in your head. There's undoubtedly people going
to
be.
Obviously, I try to explain to them that that's just Jimmy Reefercake's talent. It really has nothing to do with me. It's just how good he is.
But across the country, hundreds, if not thousands, of people will be showering tomorrow, singing your name in the shower.
And I'm probably wishing that I would go away. Which is okay.
So, Cliff, let's start with we had a series of hearings this week, which I think really the one thing that I learned from these hearings is that there's some real, real crazy people, both who testify and apparently hold these hearings in this country. Shall we start from the beginning of the week? We had the gun control hearings.
That is correct. I mean, it's true. This was just a week for fun hearings, wasn't it? We had the gun control hearings. I'm trying to think what was the highlight because there was so much good stuff.
Well, first off, we should say that Gabby Giffords gave an incredibly moving, incredibly brief, but incredibly moving testimony. Just by basically showing up and, you know, putting herself out there in that respect, which I thought was really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one can only sort of imagine what that must, you know, how difficult that must be for her and the courage it takes to do that. And so, I mean, she was amazing, and she was, you noticed that when she was testifying, Wayne LaPierre was hiding a few rows back, trying to not be caught by the cameras, because there's no way he wants to be caught in the same camera frame with Gabby Giffords. It was almost like he was ducking out left and right. It was rather pathetic. And then, of course, he came up and he showed what a mentally insane person looks like, someone who actually couldn't pass a background check, so probably doesn't want them on all people. You know, I mean, he's no different than he's been in either of his other. Times lately, media turns, let's call them, responding to the president's inauguration and their so-called press conference. He sat there and said things that didn't make sense, made up stats that don't exist. He even had to apologize at one point because he was caught lying about a stat when he said that only like 642 prosecutions had been done based on people trying to buy guns who couldn't. And the real number is like 11,000 something. He'd been taking the number just from the city of Chicago. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, Dick Durbin, of course, knew what he was doing. But I mean, he's a flat out sociopathic liar who will say anything and do anything. I mean, it's this guy has a voice in our debate. This clown is such a joke, and it kind of puts everything into perspective who the NRA is.
What's interesting is that the video, I guess, was uncovered by that dude at BuzzFeed, who is it seems to be exceptionally good at uncovering old video of Wayne LaPierre endorsing basically background checks at gun shows.
That's right. He used to support it in 99, just the way the NRA used to say that gun-free zones were a good thing, and now that's their big thing about how all the killings take place in gun-free zones, although people should know that survey research will tell you that no more than a third of them do. So the fact that they're trying to pretend that these guys are sitting there, these people that have lost their minds who get guns and shouldn't get them are sitting there irrationally saying, I think I'm going to go shoot up that school because it's a gun-free zone and there probably won't be anybody there who can shoot back. Not true. That's another lie that they perpetrate, and it's another flip-flop from where they used to be. And I think they have just done what most elements of the Republican base have done, which was in the 1990s, they were already crazy and militia happy And then their a copy of their national rifleman whatever it is magazine was found in Timothy McVeigh's car when they caught him after he blew up the building and in Oklahoma City, and they sort of had to tone down on a couple of things because finally people were kind of coming after them, and there was sort of a moderate wing still of the Republican Party back then. George H.W. Bush famously resigned from the organization when LaPierre called ATF agents jackbooted thugs and literally sort of insulted the memory of some of the people that were in the ATF and other organizations, I think maybe the FBI, who had died that day in Oklahoma City, who were friends of George Herbert Walker Bush's. So there used to be sort of that wing that would do things like that. Now, I don't.
You there? Oh, we dropped him. All right, we'll be right back, folks. Give us 1 second.
Who's been threatened and had racial animus come his way. You know, I didn't see LaPierre or anybody else back off, and I didn't see anybody else, you know, out there quit the organization over it because, again, so they've moved to the right. They've gotten crazier, and there's no doubt about that. The whole thing, it's sort of surreal. You've got David Keene, their president, sitting there in the audience, and I think he also testified at some point. I didn't catch his. You know, this is a guy whose son went to prison for shooting randomly at another driver in a case of road rage. But
that's just because he knew that people didn't have guns in their cars.
I'm sorry?
That's just because he knew that other people didn't have guns in their cars. That's when he decided to do that, right?
That's exactly right. He knew that cars often are gun-free zones. So he figured he could just start shooting. That's a great point. The whole thing, it's like, they just gave out an award to the lieutenant governor. He's their new guy. Ted Cruz, by the way, was the guy they gave their freedom award to last year. We'll get to him in a second. They just gave it to the lieutenant governor, or the guy running for lieutenant governor, I guess, of Virginia coming up because they want to give him a boost in that election. And they name it after Harlan Carter, which is the guy who founded the modern NRA after they had their little putsch, in 1977 and the hardliners took over. Came out, of course, of that guy Harlan Carter in the early 90s. It came out, or maybe in the mid, maybe in the 80s, that he had been one of the first known cases of standing your ground. When his mom complained that back home in Oklahoma, there were some Hispanic kids hanging out in the neighborhood that she didn't like. So he went and he told one of them to come with him. When the guy refused, he shot him and killed him, and was convicted of murder in a court, and it just got overturned in a technicality. That's who led the modern NRA to where it is. So, this is what you've got. And I guess the final point that would be worth bringing up is that crazy lady, Gail Trotter, who sat there
Let's play some audio. You mentioned that Gail Trotter was sort of brought up the rear, I guess it was, of the NRA's arguing in front of the Senate this week that we need these guns. And she has a pretty compelling case of why we need these assault weapons. Let's listen to her argument in front of the Senate.
Can you tell us why you believe a semi-automatic rifle such as AR-15 has value as a weapon of self-defense? And does banning guns which feature designs to improve accuracy disproportionately burden women?
I believe it does. Young women are speaking out as to why AR-15 weapons are their weapon of choice. The guns are accurate. They have good handling. They're light. They're easy for women to hold. And most importantly, their appearance. An assault weapon in the hands of a young woman defending her babies in her home becomes a defense weapon. And the peace of mind that a woman has as she's facing 3, 4, 5 violent attackers, intruders in her home with her children screaming in the background, the peace of mind that she has knowing that she has a scary looking gun gives her more courage when she's fighting hardened violent criminals. And if we ban these types of assault weapons, you are putting women at a great disadvantage, more so than men, because they do not have the same type of physical strength and opportunity to defend themselves in a hand-to-hand struggle. And they're not criminals. They're moms. They're young women. And they're not used to violent confrontations. So I absolutely urge, I speak on behalf of millions of American women across the country who urge you to defend our Second Amendment right to choose to defend ourselves.
Thank you.
I love how she throws in right to choose.
I was going to say, he's defending the right to choose, which is would be an amazing thing for the Independent Women's Forum, these right-wing kooks who spend most of their time apologizing for male rapists, date rapists and others, and saying that women brought it upon themselves. And trying to deny women the right.
Yeah, she was just basically had come out recently against the Violence Against Women Act, apparently. Because why would you need the law to say that you can't attack women in those situations if they have, you know, an AR-15 or what was it that she said? Now, let me ask you this, Cliff.
There's so many stupid things that she said there. I mean, go ahead. Ask me what you're going to ask.
Okay. Now, we know that there are thousands, if not millions, of situations happening across the country on a daily, if not hourly basis, where mothers of young children are being forced to fight off 3, 4, 5 violent, hardened intruders, probably guys who have gone through some type of weapons training themselves, who are invading these homes with the young children.
That's exactly right. I mean, I remember, like, for example, you know, when in my neighborhood, the Con Air airplane crashed in the area, and all these criminals got off, you know, the airplane, and were running rampant, just breaking into houses in the area and trying to shoot people, and everybody needed their AR-15s to protect themselves. I also remember that time when I was away and Snake Plissken showed up and tried to bust into my house.
Well, it reminds me. I have to say,
every day around every corner, Sam,
this testimony
someone trying to break in your house and kill your baby.
Reminded me of when my daughter was about 8 months old and my wife turned to me as I was heading to work and she said, "Wait a second. I don't have a semi-automatic weapon. What if that crew that came after Arnold Schwarzenegger in Raw Deal, what if they come and attempt to, you know, get the secrets from, you know, for nuclear weapons that we're storing here in the house?"
I heard they were hanging out with a gang from Codename Eraser. And together, they might get together with a couple guys who found a way to come out of the screen from The Last Boy Scout.
Yeah,
right out from the movie screen.
Yeah, these are – and then, of course, there was that one time that my sister – now, she doesn't have any children, but she was concerned at one point when we were younger, what if the Cubans and Russians invade the country – while you are out, I don't have any semi-automatic weapons to ease my mind in the house. We've obviously got to go into the hills. Now, we lived in Worcester. There are 7 hills there.
And you're trying to hide, and then Matthew Broderick gets on his War Games computer and sends off nuclear weapons at your home.
Yeah. Now,
while they're coming after you, and you somehow have to fight off a nuclear-tipped rocket, you need an AR-15.
I think the part that disgusted me the most was that
we could just
you don't have
day,
much time in these Senate hearings to bring up all these potential scenarios. And so, but honestly, to be honest, like I don't know, you know, at one point when Mila was younger, my daughter, Nikki was working, I was going to a lot of mommy and me groups. And the biggest complaint you would hear amongst young mothers was, of course, their lack of peace of mind because some liberal didn't want them to have a semi-automatic weapon around their children. And so, I don't know if we need to say any more about this.
No, I mean, the thing is that – and I'm so glad you did that, Sam, and took this where it should go because – satire is the only answer to this. I mean, I was going to sit there and actually use statistics about the likelihood of people dying more in their home with those guns and her notion to speak out for everybody, you know, when she has no stats or nothing to back up that she's speaking out for anybody but her own personal feelings, her lack of expertise, and the joke it is that somebody who has never had any expertise on guns got to show up and testify like she knows something. That's nothing different than her personal feelings that are not, you know, but the best way, I think none of that does, if I sat there and did that for the next 15 minutes, none of that does as good a job as just literally living in her world and Wayne LaPierre's world for a moment, where like around every corner is death, mayhem, doors being broken down. Like, we literally live in the Blade Runner. You know what I mean? Like, that's where we are.
Yeah. And
pick your movie, Terminator 2.
That was really stunning testimony. You got to hand it to the senators for not breaking out in laughter at when she was talking about these scenarios. I mean, I'm sure somewhere at some time that scenario may have happened. And I suppose that somewhere as these people barged in, that woman had, the AR-15 strapped to the back of the high chair so that, you know, pasted there with Velcro so she could just grab it and rip it off.
Well, having the AR-15 obviously worked out really well for Adam Lanza's mother, didn't it?
Yeah.
And having guns in the house really worked out well for Jill Van Belcher's girlfriend, didn't it?
Yeah.
And in all these states that don't have guaranteed required background checks, where they have a 38% higher rate of domestic abuse and, I mean, death, you know, by gun due to their domestic partner, then that would also – I mean, you know, again, like, I don't want to glaze people over. It's probably more fun just to satirize. I know I have more fun doing it. But
what's weird is that
she knows nothing about what she's talking about. Every statistic shows that she knows nothing what she's talking about, that she literally would be like, if I picked somebody off of the street here – and said, how do you feel? I'm scared of stuff. Okay, why don't you come talk about it in front of Congress?
What's weird.
That's the level of seriousness.
What's really sort of bizarre, and I'm going through this now, Nikki's friend is giving her a baby shower, and there's nowhere where you can register, put on your baby shower registry for any type of semi-automatic weapons. And there just seems to be such a massive lost opportunity in terms of marketing.
They really are. They're missing out on all the women's movies, too, where you could sort of just insert the semi-automatic.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
All right.
Wives Club, I think it would have gone over really well.
I don't know that we need to say any more about that. That was just sort of a stunning and, you know, the common theme as we move into the confirmation hearings for Hagel, the common theme here is that we have talked quite a bit at the disparity of the gulf between the incentive structure for national Republicans and for those sort of playing to their base on some level. The putting that Gail Trotter out there and allowing her to say the crazy on behalf of these Republican senators sort of allows that to get out there and them to play to their base. But the confirmation hearings for Chuck Hagel, I think, were an instance where there's only one area where the Republicans feel safe in really on a national stage letting their freak fly, as it were. And this was it. Now, I will preface this by saying I didn't see all of the hearings. I've only seen clips since then. I've done a lot of reading about them. Hagel clearly went into this with, at the very least, either poor study habits, a tone deafness as to what was going on. He may have been exhausted for some reason.
I think he's not drinking the night before.
I think there was a supreme overconfidence and a real sort of like lack of understanding of what's going on in his party and just where they needed to go with this.
Which is amazing because he hasn't been gone that long.
Right.
Granted, you know, the as I like to call him, the Sarah Palin with a goiter, Ted Cruz, is there now, and he's even perhaps a new level of crazy. But some of these, you know, but
– Well, we got a clip. We got a clip of Ted Cruz.
Let's let Ted Cruz speak for himself instead of me speaking.
Yeah, this is a stunning – you know, Ted Cruz had poster boards and he had a multimedia presentation. And this was – I don't know if this was the craziest thing that he was talking about. But, you know, this is the type of thing that you'd like to see Hagel be able to sort of – just simply dismiss for the idiocy it is. I know they get Hagel gets coached. Don't pick a fight. This is time for these guys to showboat. Let them showboat. It doesn't matter. But nevertheless, here's the newest senator from Texas, ladies and gentlemen, Ted Cruz.
I'd like to draw your attention to an interview you did in 2009 with Al Jazeera. And with the chairman's indulgence, if we can play an excerpt of that interview.
Pause it for 1 second. I mean, it's really all our indulgence, isn't it? I mean, this is about as indulgent as it gets. Keep going.
Right.
They couldn't get, they had a little problems with the video audio on their part, not ours.
Although we do know that all too well here.
Yeah.
Ted Cruz ran the push.
It's a very good proposition. But I believe, very firmly I believe, the current leadership around the world, that there is a moral failure going on. Unless they have a moral capacity to talk and do what they talk. For example, if you look at Palestine, there is a war crime and they are not dealing with it, but in Sudan they are dealing with it and they are really biased against it. And if you look at Sri Lanka, the Tamils being killed, there is a genocidal war going on in Sri Lanka, nothing being done. So there is a total moral...
Marty, what is your question with regards to the issue we're talking about, the reduction of nuclear weapons?
My question is that there's a total moral failure. Unless we bring these leaders to a moral standard, nothing can be done. That's my question. What do you think about it?
Okay, thank you. Let me put that to the senator.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And I said in my opening statement that that leadership is critical, because we know in life nothing is ever accomplished without leadership.
Okay, now I'm going to pause the tape now. So basically what we just heard was a clip from Al Jazeera when Hagel was on there. The caller calls in and says, you know, we're seeing leaders with no moral leadership. They're not dealing with the genocide in Palestine. They're not dealing with the they're dealing with the genocide in Sudan. And then he goes on to, I think, to talk about the Philippines. And the host says, no, well, back to our topic regarding the nuclear proliferation. And the caller says, well, yes, we need, my point is that we need moral leadership to deal with this. And Hagel says, well, yes, you're absolutely right. We need moral leadership. And he goes on. And then, of course, Ted Cruz.
Nobody's ever been on a phone call. Like, I'm sure Ted Cruz has never been on. First of all, Ted Cruz is the crazy guy.
Ted Cruz is the guy making those phone calls.
Right.
But wait, let's hear. Now,
I mean,
I wanted to lay the predicate.
I've been on shows. I was on C-SPAN when my book came out.
Now, wait a second. I want to stop for a second, because we're going to play now what Ted Cruz. He's using this as the predicate for the next question. Now, the reason why I'm breaking it up like this is because you got to wonder where Ted Cruz is going to go with this, and it's to the most sort of ridiculous place. Go ahead.
Senator Hagel, the caller suggests that the nation of Israel has committed war crimes. And your response to that was not to dispute that characterization, but indeed to describe what he said as, quote, well, I think that's exactly right.
So there you have it. Ted Cruz basically says, you did not address the first. Oh, is there more? Okay, keep playing.
I'd like to ask you, do you think the nation of Israel has committed war crimes?
No.
And he says no there, right?
But no, oh, I do not, Senator. I'd want to look at the full context of the interview, but to answer your question, no.
Okay, so there it is. So he says says no. Now this
phew,
is
phew. That's good to know.
Yeah,
that this
I mean,
guy who spilled his blood in a foreign land and served his country, unlike Ted Cruz, and was awarded for doing that and sacrificing. You know, whether one agrees with the war or not, the fact of what one guy in Chuck Hagel has been willing to do for their country instead of this little lunatic in Ted Cruz, who actually came out and said there was a plot by the UN to take away our golf courses. I'm not kidding you.
Well, that's of course true. That's Agenda 21. Everybody knows that. Now, but the point is that now I happen to think that Israel has actually engaged in war crimes over the years, but putting that issue aside, the idea that a grown-up could actually get up there and accuse Hegel of saying that, because, of course, you know, in our politics, that would be the death knell, because he didn't address the different things. Hegel also didn't address what was going on in Sudan or the Philippines, as far as I could tell, or anything else. It's just
he never responded to the movie Mars Attacks, you know, and tried to explain why we allowed those little guys to come down without first doing background checks and meet with them so that they could shoot their ray guns at all of us. That would have been something that maybe Chuck Hegel could have answered.
it was, but you know, and Hegel should have been like, well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear, Senator, that I was ignoring the part of the conversation, the question that was way off topic, and I was addressing his basic premise, which was that we need moral leadership to deal with nuclear issues, and I think that's true. That would have been a very easy thing to say. Now, he's not that adept at it. Here's John McCain, well, I mean, I don't know that anybody knows more about the real McCain than you do. But here's John McCain desperately seeking someone else to believe that John McCain was right about Iraq. Here it is.
Do you stand by those comments, Senator Hegel?
Well, Senator, I stand by them because I made them. And
were you right? Were you correct in your assessment?
Well, I would defer to the judgment of history to put that out. But
the committee deserves your judgment as to whether you were right or wrong about the surge.
I'll explain why I made those comments. And
I want to know if you were right or wrong. That's a direct question. I expect a direct answer.
The surge assisted in the objective. But if we review the record a little bit.
Will you please answer the question? Were you correct or incorrect when you said that the surge would be the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam? Were you correct or incorrect? Yes or no?
My reference to the surge being the most dangerous.
Senator Hegel, the question is, were you right or wrong? That's a pretty straightforward question.
Well,
I would like to answer whether you're right or wrong, and then you are free to elaborate.
Well, I'm not going to give you a yes or no answer
well,
on a lot of things.
Well, let me show that
today.
You refuse to answer that question. Now, please go ahead.
Well, if you would like me to explain why.
I would like an answer, yes or no.
Well, I'm not going to give you a yes or no. I think it's far more complicated than that. As I've already said, my answer is I'll defer that judgment to history. As to the comment I made about the most dangerous foreign policy decision since Vietnam was about not just the surge, but the overall war of choice going into Iraq. That particular decision that was made on the surge, but more to the point, our war in Iraq, I think was the most fundamentally bad, dangerous decision since Vietnam.
Now, I mean, I think his point is well taken there. He could have said it a far more eloquently. He could have said, no, in retrospect, that was the second biggest mistake we made. The first one was Iraq, and then the second one was compounding the issue there and keeping us in there longer than necessary. But tell me the background. You know John McCain, not personally, but you wrote the book.
He called me unstable. And called me a known liar. So it's almost like we're buddies.
It's close. Cliff wrote the book The Real McCain back in the day. So give us some background on Hegel and McCain.
Well, a few quick things. First of all, that's classic McCain. That's the bully. That's the guy I wrote about in my book who the side of him, the anger that drives John McCain more than anything else, revenge. And I'll get to that in 2 seconds, why he needs revenge against Hegel, what led him to call his wife the "see you next Tuesday." Everybody can figure that one out, I'm sure. Led him to physically assault a congressman, you know, from his own delegation after taunting the guy. Led him to throw all sorts of four-letter insults at John Cornyn, Chuck Grassley, Pete Domenici. Not to say that I wouldn't like to do that sometimes.
Right.
But this man was a senator on the floor and sort of physically threatened people. This is who he is. And with Hegel, it fits that pattern perfectly, because Hegel and McCain actually were once good buddies when McCain was more sane before he went the neocon route and got in with those guys. McCain was once a guy who actually called for us to pull out it's not coming to me. I'm losing my mind. But Lebanon, sorry. Libya kept popping in. Called for us to pull out of Lebanon in 1983 after the barracks attack. He was a guy who was not a neocon of any sort. He was much more like Hegel and other people who had been to wars and were more careful about it. He went total neocon in the late 90s for a variety of reasons, dealing with his party, getting the nomination, who was advising him, and other things like that. But to make a long story short, he and Hegel had been friends, and so in 2000, as both guys that were injured in war, in 2000 when McCain ran, Hegel was only one of four senators that endorsed John McCain over George W. Bush. Most of the Senate hated McCain because of his personality and went with Bush. But what happened is, as Hegel started coming out against the war and McCain went in the opposite direction and said, surge, surge, surge. And by the way, for anybody listening, it was the Sunni awakening and a variety of other things, not the surge, which led to over 1,000 more American troops dying and untold other horrors over there. But as Hegel started to question the very premise of the war, which is something that John McCain can't allow to happen, because then he would have to admit that he pushed for us to go into a war that was completely ill thought out, was completely idiotic, and frankly, yeah, pretty close to being a war crime, if not one. And so Hegel came out very publicly around 2006, 2007, and they really broke in a serious way. And McCain started to hate him after that. And Hegel, in the end, Hegel's wife endorsed Obama in 2008. Hegel just sort of stayed neutral but refused to endorse McCain. It was pretty clear whose side Hegel was on. So this is now all personal, is what people should know. It's well beyond. It's that Hegel questioned McCain's judgment, and nobody ever questions McCain's judgment on Iraq without personally saying, "I'm questioning McCain's judgment." He just said, "I'm questioning the justification for having done this, that we made a terrible mistake." Hegel actually did support the war with his vote at the time, but was sort of one of these guys that was sort of hesitant, and I think felt terrible when he saw how it turned out. To give him some credit, and I'm not saying Hegel's perfect, because on a whole number of issues, I think he's terrible. But I think on this, as someone who had been to war and understands what that's like, he came to realize an error he made and wanted to speak out about it even before most Democrats were. And to McCain, that was a direct personal challenge to King McCain.
And so,
nobody does that. And then when his wife sort of made it obvious, Hegel's wife, that they were supporting Obama in 2008 over him, I mean, of course, that was it.
Right. You know, nobody puts McCain in the corner. Nobody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We've made so many awesome movie references today.
But we can just
start going off on those. But yeah, yeah. And that's the long and the short of it, right?
And these hearings, and of course, Lindsey Graham also got in on this, I think, and Ted Cruz, well, as we saw. But
in Lindsey Graham's defense, he was off in a Baghdad market, I think last week, shopping for good rugs again.
Right, so right. With the helicopters really overhead. Now. It seems to me that these hearings, again, this is these hearings in particular, the perfect storm. They want to attack a former Republican because they don't want to make they don't have the partisan argument. But it's also sort of like a freebie. They can let their freak fly and play to their base and not really have it cost them anything, because I think Americans are just not as invested in foreign policy now as they were. And so Graham can show his sort of neocon bona fides, which is going to be important for his reelection. And all of these, Ted Cruz can become the sort of the next Sarah Palin, but in the Senate. Now that he's got the breathing room without Jim DeMint there, he's going to guaranteed to come in the pole position on the crazy race.
Right.
And
I mean, I'll say quickly, the Graham thing is almost hysterical because, Saxby Chambliss just decided not to run because that lunatic obviously wasn't conservative enough for the electorate in Georgia. In Kentucky, they're trying to field a Tea Party or against Mitch McConnell because he's not conservative enough, and his approval rating now, largely because a lot of his base has completely abandoned him, is now at 34%, right? So if you want to look at this sort of the third of almost this triumvirate of guys in these southern states that are right-wing as you can be, but still not right-wing enough for their states, you'd add in Lindsey Graham. And Lindsey Graham, who's talking about his AR-15, like every time he opens his mouth about the AR-15 he owns, I mean, sorry, I hate to do this, but you think he's overcompensating for something? I can't put my finger on what it is, but it's something he has to deal with in his own life because there are a lot of people on the right that are questioning him because of whatever they think about him, and he feels a need to do something to close those questions down. And I'll tell you, man, I mean, he's going to be slaughtered in a primary in South Carolina. And it's funny to watch these guys how they don't realize it. They think they can feign.
Well, he's
going
to have to
right.
take that AR-15 out of the closet and brandish it if he wants to go anywhere in that race. But I mean, it's interesting to see because this is
he does take a lot of practice with his gun to make sure that he shoots straight. Mm. So that's important to know.
Well, all right. But it is interesting to me to see, you know, sort of that's the last vestige for these guys is to be able to sort of, you know, talk about this sort of highly aggressive neocon foreign policy, because of course nobody feels like they're in the position to do anything about it. So it doesn't get the same attention as it would if, you know, John McCain was running for office. He can sing bomb, bomb, bomb Iran all the time he wants now because everybody knows he's not in a position to do anything about it.
In Lindsey Graham's case, you've got like literally the neocon foreign policy and the gun, his AR-15 are all about trying to make South Carolina conservatives that will never, ever like him. And I just feel like we've watched this game. You know, we watched Dick Lugar try to move from being a reasonable guy, you know, who actually was much more moderate than Lindsey Graham, to move to the right to no avail, losing to Mr. Rape is what God bestows upon you. Richard Murdoch in a primary there, you know, these guys can try to do this feint to the right, you know, and it's just not going to work. They're not going to buy it. You know, Lindsey Graham, these guys hate him, and he's now also, you know, on immigration. So, it's like he's trying to play this game. And I mean, it ends up turning these hearings into a farce.
Indeed.
You know? I mean, Ted Cruz is a joke again. He might as well be Sarah Palin with a goiter.
Well, listen, Cliff, we have run out of time, but there was a couple other things I wanted to talk to you about. I guess I'm going to have to get to the NRA enemy list that they keep on their website. I'm going to have to get to that later in the program. I am sad to say I've gone over it. We haven't called it, you know, we haven't put it to a forensic test, but you don't seem to be on it.
And I know that. And I'm pissed about that. I got a lot of people to insult me on the front page of their website once.
I know. So, it's really, there's no justice in this country.
I thought I was there and now I'm disappointed. So I promise you, I'm going to redouble my efforts.
Okay. Well, Cliff, we will talk to you next week. Appreciate you spending the time with us.
I always enjoy it. Thanks,
right.
Sammy.
Cliff Schechter, everyone. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Graham, the comedian whose show, This Too Shall Suck, has actually gotten very good reviews. Apparently does not suck as much as he had anticipated it would. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to this program a guy who, you know, there was a couple of comedians when I started comedy who were sort of like, you know, I was like sort of like I felt like I was like a freshman in high school. And these guys were the seniors. And, you know, guys like Marin and David Cross and this guy, Matt Graham, whose show is getting great reviews. It's off-Broadway show, This Too Shall Suck, which is playing at the, what is it, Soho Playhouse? Matt, welcome to the show.
It's the Soho Playhouse, yeah, down on Van Dam Street, 15 Van Dam.
And let me just say this. Let's see, what is it? Where's the quote? About life history. Okay. It's the story of one man's transformation from a total loser into not quite as much of a loser.
That about sums it up. You know, I'm one of those guys who like, yeah, he quit drinking, and he was a lush, but his life never really seemed to get any better. You mentioned you called me a senior and I haven't graduated. all those other guys are, you know, I'm still taking night courses, and all those other guys have gone on to, you know, fame and fortune and college degrees.
Well,
so to speak.
I got to tell you, I don't go really to see comedy much. I desperately want to go see your show, and I'm going to, and I'm glad it's gotten such great reviews. I'm not, to be honest with you, terribly surprised by that, but there are
you are or aren't.
I'm not. I mean, I've always been a really big fan of your comedy. There are very few jokes that I remember, but I remember a joke that you would do. It's 20 years now, I think, that I probably saw you do this joke. It's sort of scary to say that, but
easily, because I wasn't doing much comedy after like 93.
Right. And, no, yeah. I mean, it was the early 90s out of Catch a Rising Star. And the joke, I don't even know if you remember doing this joke, but I mean, it is, I don't want to butcher it, but it's, I am a workaholic, which is why I can never work. And that, did I butcher it? But that was one of my.
Yeah, that's one of my Conan sets. Weirdly enough, a guy just, who came to my show last night just had, I guess he was watching some sets of mine, you know, on my Comedy Central site or whatever. Not my, I didn't put it there. I didn't even know it was there until he told me it was. You didn't really butcher it? No, it's, I'm a workaholic, which is why I can never work. I'm recovering. Say even light work, I can't touch it at all. You know, it's like if I like help a lady with a bag of groceries, I'll wake up in the Peace Corps. I think those were the taglines. But my show, and just for what it's worth, you know, I don't want to say. I mean, I was proud of the comedy I did, but you know, I could easily be categorized a bit as a specialty comic. You know, I would bomb badly as often as I would really kill, and I didn't have a lot of audience connect. And this show is, I'm doing some stand up that is somewhat more like my old stand up on the side, but the show is really, I have a real deep connection with the audience, and I'm a lot more open and friendly. And it's just a different thing I'm trying to do, you know?
Yeah.
It's 20 years, like you said, a lot's gone on.
I mean, and I think the last time I ran into you, was probably, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, and you were trying out. I'm not even sure I fully get, you were trying out for a college basketball team, which is, I don't want a spoiler alert for part of the show, but that I was like, wait, what?
No, you can mention that, and I talk.
You're in your late 30s though when you did that,
huh?
You were in your late 30s when you did that, weren't you?
I was, yeah, 38 when I first started, you know, not working on it. I started working on it around 35, where I started getting down to Hunter and playing a lot of ball with the guys. And, you know, it's one of those situations where, like in my show, you know, I'm kind of able to, you know, there's been so much media about me. I'm kind of able to set things right from my perspective. People can believe me or not believe me, you know. Like, you know, the sentence that's written about it in the book, whatever, is straightforward, but it could leave. The long and short of it is, I would have, like, told the coaches there something like, you know, I can get national media and plan to write a book, but it seemed pretty apparent I was going to make the team just on my basketball skills. So I didn't want to taint it. And then, you know, when I was cut, I was surprised. And basically, the head coach was real nice. He was very honest. He was kind of surprised, too. He's like, well, I had you in my top 10 pretty clearly, but there were two coaches who didn't want you on the team, and they were adamant about it, and I got to work with them. I was bummed out because I'd put a lot of hard work in and I had played great in practice, but at the same time, I was kind of relieved because I've had osteoarthritis started developing in my teens. So, you know the movie White Men Can't Jump?
Yeah.
Yeah, white men couldn't walk after I practiced out there. I went to York, you know, so I would, like, limp upstairs.
But wait a second, Matt, you're blowing through the sort of, like, you appreciate that when somebody says, like, I'm in my mid-30s, I'm going back to college to play college basketball. You appreciate that that sounds, like, weird, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't mind that it sounds unorthodox or whatever. I mean, I just loved hoops, right? So at that point, I was not interested in performing during that period. I never thought I was performing again. I hadn't yet learned to play poker. I wanted a direction, and I never had played organized basketball. But, you know, during my best years, I was, you know, a very strong presence on Upper East Side half court. You know,
no, I played basketball with you. You're a good basketball player. I mean, I was a mediocre enough basketball player where I could appreciate how good you were. But even still, like, what? I mean, I know that there are people listening to the program going, like, wait a second, like, I don't understand. You went back to college. Well, just walk through the mechanics of this just a little bit, because I think it's, I think people just don't. It sort of is not in people's wheelhouse of understanding.
You got to understand me, first of all. I'm a strange guy. You know that.
Yes.
I marched definitely, you know, to the beat of my own drummer. It was a period of big change. Like I said, I started losing kind of interest in comedy around 93, which would have been a year after I took up Scrabble. I still worked, but it was mostly on the road. I wasn't pursuing. I was, you know, I'd first gotten to New York, and I was not pursuing sets or comedy work. I just found the world kind of discouraging. And also, I have to say that, like, for whatever it's worth, you know how comedy is, and you know how comedy, when you're a young man, you're like, it gets under your skin when other people get things and you want things. And
right.
It can be a torturous way to live. You know what I mean? If
yes.
You don't have a balancing point. And, you know, I didn't have a balancing point of, like, marriage or other career, you know, so I was like, I can't take this anymore. So I kind of, like, what would you say? I sort of, like, went through recovery on the envy and stuff like that. Changed a lot. Unfortunately, it changed my ambition, too, because then I no longer had ambition to even work at all. So I was just playing Scrabble. Then at some point, I quit drinking, which, you know, my need to do it would surprise no one, but the fact that it actually happened surprises even me.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the show. But it did. And then I was like, shit, well, now I got all this time and energy, and what am I going to do? You know, I mean, I don't have a college degree, you know. I don't have a high school degree, pardon me. So, you know, I couldn't get work at a Starbucks, really, or anything. And I was like, well, you know, I'm a good ball player, and I never played organized. I'd love to do that. And so I started going down to Hunter, which was near my house, and playing, and fared real well against, you know, the recreational players and the guys on the team. Actually, the starting point guard down there was my favorite, you know, because some people.
Wait a second. Did you enroll in the college first?
What?
Did you enroll?
No, I couldn't just enroll in college because I didn't have a degree or a GED or an SAT.
So
first I went and investigated the possibilities by hanging out down there playing open gym.
Yeah.
And when that looked promising, as I said, more people hated my game than liked it, not because it wasn't effective, but because it really bothered them that it didn't seem like I should be being able to score on them or rebound on them or guard them, you know, because, you know, my knees were beat to hell and I wasn't that quick to begin with. But the starting point guard down there gave me, like, my favorite all-time court nickname, which was the Warrior, because I played insanely hard and with complete abandon. And
yes, I mean, I used to play pickup games with you, with people who were, most of the people who played were just not, were not that good. It was, you know, it was like a, sort of like almost like a comedian game in a way. And you were pretty merciless, if I recall. Like,
I was pretty what?
You were merciless in terms of like, both playing against them and also sort of you had high expectations for your teammates.
I was a douchebag, you know, probably during those years. But as we talked about, I was still the, like, young comic who had not done what was expected of him as a comic. You know, I became a better sport and less of a douchebag. I mean, players would still frustrate me, but they had to be a lot worse or a lot dumber or a lot more selfish to do it.
Okay,
you know, back when
good.
We used to play in Jamaica Plain, you know, I was just a lot more.
Well, I'm actually talking, like, I remember playing with you at Chelsea Piers. And, yes, there was definitely an improvement. You were far more forgiving. But I played a couple of those games down there.
You know, we all grow. I mean, it may have been easier for me because I started from such a bad point, you know. But, like, I'm kind of thankful for that because, you know, between having so much to improve on from having such a volatile, confrontational personality and, like, being a heavy, heavy drinker, you know, there was so much I could change. And then it makes it seem, you know, it makes it seem more oppressive when I'm
yeah, it's like the old saying in school, like, get behind early because it gives you more time to catch up.
Right.
Well, now, wait a second. So you've gone through the Scrabble tournaments. You came in, I think, second, like, in one world champion in the late 90s. And then.
Yeah, 97.
And yeah, you were in a documentary, I remember, and there was a lot of, I don't know, Scrabble was at its peak popularity at that time, it feels like. Maybe I was just more in touch with the popularity of Scrabble because...
No, after that, this book, I was just talking to the author yesterday, it's really being released on ebook soon. It was a New York Times bestseller that was called Word Freak by Stefan Fatsis, and that came out, and I was really the biggest character aside from the narrator. And then a few years after that, a movie came out called Word Wars, which was one of the movies I was going to give a recommend on, both because I'm back in the business of selling myself, and I'm in it a lot, but also because it was pretty good. It was at Sundance. So, you know, if you haven't seen it and you like a little bit about Scrabble, that's one of my recommends.
Well, there you go, folks. We already got our movie recommendation for the week, and that's not even – it's like an unconscious movie recommendation.
Well, I want to recommend, I decided that, you know, my mind went different directions. I told you I live under a rock, and so I didn't want to recommend Casablanca, even though that's the last movie I saw that really affected me.
When it was released.
It took me 45 years to see it. I thought about Inside Marilyn Chambers because it's so funny, but I was afraid the hardcore porn would distract people from the funniness. And so then I thought of the movie with me in it, but that's kind of cheesy. So I came up with two recommendations that people might
All right, but wait
seen.
A second. Before what we get to your recommendations.
The Heart is a Lonely
Heart. No, hold on. Wait. Before we get to the recommendations, I want to finish this,
sure.
The college basketball story, but the short version. Like, okay, so you're practicing with these guys. You get the sense in your head, all right, I can compete. Then do you go and do you get your GED? Do you sign up for college? I mean, what happens?
Well, you know, I just took the SAT first because, you know, these were CUNY schools and they weren't all that hot. And I figured just a good SAT score would get me in, you know, and that was kind of like easier to take, as I recall. So I took that and I didn't get such a hot score, but I did get a perfect verbal. You know, and the math, what made the score bad was that, I got all the math right except for geometry, but I missed all the geometry because by the time I was taking geometry, I was just sleeping during class on the days I was there, which weren't many.
I'm glad to hear they got perfect verbal. I'm not surprised by that. I mean, you're a Scrabble champion, for God's sakes.
What? Well, Scrabble's more of a math game, really, you know, so, I don't know if people know that, but it's 90% your math brain and 10% your verbal. Oh. Either way, they still couldn't get me in, even though my mean SAT was, you know, several hundred points higher than the average student. I still needed to take the GED, where I did worse than the SAT, largely because there were a couple of parts that were subjectively judged. But it didn't matter. It was enough to get me in, and I enrolled at York College. Very near where I live now. I live in Kew Gardens, and it's in Jamaica, Queens. And, you know, like I said, it was a disappointment because it seemed like I would make it, but at the same time, it was a great experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I was, like I said, I'm not sure my knees could have made the whole season of practice.
And so, wait, did you continue with college or no? Did you blow it off at that point?
Well, I went, but I was having a hard time making the grade. It's like, you know, I don't like getting up in the morning. And I'm sure you've heard this in different realms where people go back to school and they're like, oh, when I went to school, I was so young and I feel so blessed. I'm doing it over again and I get so much more out of it. I hated school just as bad as I always hated it when I went back to college. I mean, I didn't like it any better at all. I didn't like the hours. I didn't like the authority figures, you know. I had this speech teacher out there who, like, I missed his first week, whatever. You know, I had an hour and a half trip each way each day because I was living in Harlem. And I missed his first week, and he calls me outside. And that's fine. I mean, if he wants to say, you can't do that again. But he treated me like I was 7 years old, you know, when he was older than me, but, you know, I'm only, you know, only 10 years or so. And he just acted like a real, I don't know, you know. I don't like authority. And,
yes,
and he,
I know. I think that's coming through.
He was savoring his authority. And so I just hassled him the whole rest. It's actually, I would have finished the semester, but he was going to flunk me. and that was going to damage my basketball GPA if I wanted to go elsewhere and play. So that's actually why I what's the term for unenroll? There's, you know, there's some sort of official term. I can't remember it now.
Hiatus,
yeah.
I think.
He was a collegiate speech teacher, and he would say antidote when he meant anecdote. So when people get up and tell a story, he'd say, yes, but that's an antidote, you know. And I'm like, an antidote for what? Did somebody bitten by a black widow? What happened here? So I just antagonized him all I could, and so my perfect attendance from the point of the lecture bought me no quarter, you know.
I feel like I wish I had just enrolled just to watch this go down, frankly. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I find that would have been just fun to watch you.
Well, but there were cool people, too. I mean, a couple of the teachers were real nice. I had a sociology teacher the second time. I felt bad I couldn't finish that course. You know, it definitely was not the institution of highest learning. So there were a couple of, like, sort of zombied-out teachers just really mailing it in. Like, I went up with it to a psychology professor to discuss this. Just this concept that I thought was interesting. We were talking about primary and secondary motivators that day.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that at all from college psych? Mm-hmm. How, you know, let's say food, water, and sex are primary motivators.
Okay.
And then money and prestige or whatever are secondary motivators. And I went up to him and I was like, look, I was thinking, I wondered. And, you know, I knew he was kind of like, he just liked to get to his tennis matches that day. So I don't know why I should have talked to somebody else, but he was my teacher. And I went up and said, now, I was wondering, you know, because in New York you see so much focus on money. Is it possible that money consumes some people so much that it becomes a primary motivator? Like they can't separate it, you know, from even something like that they need, that's biological drive, but they can't live without, like sex. And he just looked at me and he's like, money is a secondary motivator. That was his response, you know. It was really great. And, you know, my actually English teacher was really nice. It was very funny because my writing is so sloppy and bad, you know. I've written a 20,000-word book proposal that we're going to be shopping soon again about my strange life, and it needs, you know, all kinds of help with grammar and punctuation, and I haven't capitalized anything for years out of sloth.
Well, it sounds like you could get a job here as one of our producers.
Well, yeah, no, I'm sure there's so many things that I'm qualified for just by my incompetent side. You know, I got this Peter Principle game to kind of study up how I can make money. Because, you know, I always keep myself from making money by being talented, and that bothers people. So I want to find areas where I'm really, really
Oh, your phone cut out. Hold on for a second, folks. We'll call you right back.
Do, 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 do. What's going on with the music?
Oh, there we go.
Do, 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 do.
Hey, you sure you don't want to use this other phone?
No, this is fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
All right. So, well, you know, I mean, I think sometimes maybe you go. It's easier, probably at times, I think, to go into those areas where you're not as talented because you have a little bit less emotional involvement in it too. It's a little bit easier, I think, to succeed in some areas because of that.
I know this now. I mean, I'm going to do. You know, I'm thrilled to be doing my show, and I want to do other stuff. You know, related to that. I mean, you know, whether it's, I mean, I'm also doing my stand up, which is different, and I want to write. You're still there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. This, you know, because you were sort of choppy the whole time, and I have this kind of learning disabled phone in an era of smart ones, and so, you know, I have to work with it all the time. You know, yeah, I'm happy to be back doing what I'm doing because truly I believe it's my best gift and calling. But at the same time, like I was telling the author of the book yesterday, you know, I'm a big basketball fan and a big college basketball fan, and I root for Butler's my favorite team. You know, I like underdogs and teams that achieve more than you'd think they would, and that's how I played basketball. But, you know, as a writer of humor in those areas, I'm like, you know, I'm like the 7-footer who just kind of wants to hang out and shoot 3-pointers. And, you know, nobody can ever motivate him to, like, get to the basket or rebound. And so I want to do a better job. I'm like a guy nearing the end of his career, you know?
Well, and I got to tell you, I mean, I'm impressed with the reviews you got. I'm definitely going to get down there. This too shall suck. It's every Thursday night at the Soho Playhouse. All right, but we're running out of time. So let's get to those two movie picks or one movie pick.
Sure. The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, mid-60s, Alan Arkin, Sandra Locke, you know, a couple of Stacy Keach, one of the greatest tearjerker films of all time. I don't know why more people don't know it. And The Triplets of Belleville, a really funny animated film with a lot of, like, visual humor and kind of an animation style that reminds you of pre-68 Disney. So
cool.
Those are my two movies that some people may not have seen that I think are fantastic.
Excellent. And I would encourage everybody to check out the documentary. I'm sure that's on Netflix and Amazon. It's Word Wars, right?
The Word Wars, and it is on both of those things. It is streaming. You know, more than anything, I want them to see my show, which hopefully will be a film in the next year or two. I hope Ira Glass is listening. But,
my guess is he's not, with all due respect to me.
The show is I recommend it ahead of The Heart. It's my show's not as good as Triplets of Belleville, but it's better than The Heart is a Lonely Hunter.
There you go, folks. So. This too shall suck. We will put a link to the show site, thistooshallsuck.com. Matt, really great to catch up with you, and I'm looking forward to seeing the show, and thanks so much for coming on and talking to us.
Great hearing from you, Sam. Thanks for your time, man. Have a good one.
All right, you too. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. Yes, indeed. You can call me at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. What, Scott Brown not running? Wow. That's interesting. We'll talk more about that in the better half of the program. Scott Brown not running in Massachusetts. Hopefully, Markey will beat Stephen Lynch in the primary, I guess. It's going to put a lot more emphasis on that primary, that's for sure, because there's nobody else, there's no Republican that's going to win. My guess is Scott Brown is going to try and run for governor in a couple of years, but, lay off the Twitter would be my recommendation to him. Folks, folks, your support is essential to keeping this show alive. You can become a member at majority.fm/support the show, or just click on the link up top. There's other ways of supporting the show. Of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% discount, coupon code majority. Buy your Amazon crap through our Amazon link. Very easy to click on that link, bookmark it, buy all your stuff. You won't notice a difference. We will. And we'll see you in the better half.